Breaking news out of the world of the NFL in the last hour or so. Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay has died at age 65. He was the owner of the team since 1997. He was always one of the more vocal and involved owners in the National Football League. You could tell he had a real desire to win, had a desire to keep himself in the news cycle a little bit as well. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast. And he did some remarkable things for the Indianapolis Colts as an organization. Of course, they won a Super Bowl in 2006. One of the first things he did upon ownership of the team was the Colts drafted Peyton Manning, and he became a stalwart, one of the greatest quarterbacks in NFL history, and was a mainstay with the organization. He followed that up with drafting Andrew Luck, who might to this day be considered the most highly touted prospect in NFL draft history, who was a great player, abruptly kind of retired, and the last few years have been sort of a circus. But yeah, breaking news out of the NFL there. Indianapolis Colts owner and CEO Jim Irsay has died at age 85. Sticking around the world of the NFL, apparently the tush push will stay. Debate over the infamous, as it's now called, tush push was very hotly contested. Apparently, according to reports earlier today, there was a heated exchange between owners and league executives during the league meeting in Minnesota. Philadelphia owner Jeffrey Lurie, according to ESPN, made an impassioned speech in defense of the play. The Eagles and the NFL declined comment, but sources close to Lurie told ESPN that he had seen reports from earlier in the day that the tush push was going to be banned, and so he figured the odds of the play's survival were long. He made a speech that lasted close to an hour. Close to an hour. You defended the tush push in a room with other grown men for an hour. Okie dokie. He was later, I guess, chastised in the meeting by Troy Vincent, who is the executive vice president of football operations for the NFL, for using a quote. He used the words wet dream when talking about whether you ban the play or not, it's a win-win for the Eagles. That they created a play that was so successful that the only way to stop it was for it to be banned. So either we can continue using it, or we just change the NFL by making you ban this play because we were so good at it. He was chastised for that comment. Apparently there were tempers flared a little bit. Jason Kelce was in attendance. He addressed the room talking about the tush push. He said that he would return to the NFL if he could run 60 tush pushes a game. Interesting. So with all of this in mind, they still failed to ban it. So the tush push stays in the NFL. Surprise, surprise.
It did get close, though.
Got close. I mean, according to the ESPN, right? According to the sources they were talking to, it was going to get banned. And then there was an hour-long impassioned speech about grown men being able to push other grown men. But here we are. I don't know. It's a weird one. The tush push sticks around for a year longer. I don't know. I go back and forth on the tush push. Because I understand the game of football and I understand the physicality of it. And there are times, right? Like Trey Smith is iconic for at the end of a run, getting himself behind the pile and pushing it forward. I'm okay with situations like that when they happened. What I have a problem with when it comes to the tush push is that it is a designed play. It is designed to be to have a man pushed by other men forward. That's where I draw the line. That's why I believe in like a ban of the tush push, because if it occurs organically throughout the course of play, okay. If a running back has a dive through the B gap and he gains 4 yards and he gets stood up and the scrum happens, okay. But when you've got the offensive line lining up under center at a 45 degree angle, the quarterback is as tightly behind the, he's hiding his entire body behind the quarterback, and there are a fullback and two tight ends on either side of the quarterback whose one and only job is to push him forward. If it occurs organically, fine. But as a play design, I think that's a little bit bush league. Maybe that's just me.
I think that they should allow defenses to push. Like, let them have a counter. Because currently, I think right now, you're not allowed to push your own teammate. Correct. If you're on defense. So I think if you just allow that, that fixes a little bit of the problem, makes it a little more equal.
Yeah, because if you think about it, a tush push, right, or a quarterback sneak, what have you, is a play that's designed to gain a yard, 2 yards, 3 yards. Linebackers are lined up 4 or 5 yards off the ball. So you typically, whether it's a three technique or four, you're now sitting there thinking, okay, if you combine the quarterback, the tight ends on either side, the fullback, tailback, or tight end that's lined up behind Hurts, and 5 offensive linemen, there are now 4 guys, 4 down linemen defensively, or 3, trying to stop 9 grown men from a yard, 2 or 3 forward. What? Make them announce it? Oh, that's interesting. Like with the onsides nowadays, you have to acknowledge to the officials, hey, we're going to be performing the tush push now. We're going to be performing a quarterback sneak. And then the defensive line can, or the defense entirely can adjust to it accordingly. They can put 7 guys, they can run into a goal line set, put 8 guys on the line of scrimmage to try to combat it. I'm not against it. They got to do something, because I think it's completely and utterly bush league. It's also not entertaining, in my opinion. And the National Football League, like every other professional sports organization, is an entertainment venue. It is an entertainment-driven medium. That's why they've made all these changes to kickoffs. That's why they made the change to the extra point, because it's not fun. It's not entertaining to watch. I don't enjoy watching the tush push. I don't care if the Chiefs do it. I wouldn't enjoy watching the tush push. I think it's dumb. But that's just me. Couple of news and notes surrounding the Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs made a move yesterday. They signed Tremaine Antrim, a veteran offensive lineman, primarily lined up as guard. He has played in 31 games, made 1 start with the Los Angeles Rams after he was drafted in the 7th round in 2020. He was a tackle in college, but he got moved to guard in the National Football League. I don't have a ton of notes about this, I guess. I don't have much to make out of this situation. He's just a depth piece, right? A guy you could bring in training camp and see, right? I don't know if he's there to kind of push Nick Allegretti to some extent or push Kingsley Suamataia as he tries to make the transition from tackle to guard. The Chiefs waived Keontae Ingram with an injury designation on Thursday and was put on the Chiefs injured reserve list. They also put a Justin Lockhart on an injury settlement and released him as well. The other story I've got surrounding the Kansas City Chiefs, Pro Football Focus came out with their 25 under 25 rankings, the top 25 players in the National Football League under the age of 25. And sliding in at number 5, Trent McDuffie, who last year was number 10 on the list. He's now in the top 5. Pro Football Focus had this to say about McDuffie. Quote, McDuffie went from being a top five nickel cornerback in Pro Football Focus overall grade for Steve Spagnuolo's defense in 2023 to a top five outside cornerback in 2024. He is the NFL's highest rated corner since 2023. He has an 89.4 PFF coverage grade since entering the league in 2022, which is a top five mark among all cornerbacks and makes him the only one in the top 10 to have spent more than 25% of their career snaps in the slot. So surprise, surprise to no one in Chiefs Kingdom. Trent McDuffie's pretty damn good at football. 913-586-7965 is our number. We've got a lot of conversation about the tush push. Somebody said, just taking a look, you know, whether, because it wasn't banned. So what is your reaction to it? 22-10 should have easily passed 2/3. I don't know if it had to be a unanimous decision or a 75%. I think it's 75% actually in the National Football League. So they needed 24 in order for it to pass. But I don't know. I don't understand. I won't begin to understand the politics of the owners' meetings in the National Football League. My thing is forward progress, not being blown and letting someone other than the runner advance himself. I talked about this briefly. If it happens during the course of a play, if it just happens naturally, if it's not designed that way, okay, I'm okay with that. What I have a problem with is for it to be a play in your playbook, and the design of that play is for a guy to get pushed forward for added yards to try to extend your drive. That I have a problem with. Whether tush push or a scrum, I think it's a terrible play. I agree. I think it's dumb. My thing, right. How the F are you supposed to tackle Hurts when everyone's surrounding him, carrying him for a yard? Yeah, exactly. What are you supposed to do? Tackle all 11 guys? Fantastic point. Allow the defensive line to cut if everyone knows the tush push is coming. If every team in the NFL could line up and run a tush push at a 93% success rate, then yes, ban it. But how many teams have tried it and failed? Well, not many have tried it with any real consistency. I mean, the Bills were over 80% successful at it last season. The Eagles have been incredibly successful at it. And yeah, fair. The Eagles do it better than everybody else does. That doesn't make it an interesting play. That doesn't raise the entertainment value of the league. I think that it is completely and utterly Bush League. That's my opinion. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, we've got a lot more coming up here on the program, including some NBA stories that I want to get to. We've got a new MVP in the league, and we are going to have a new NBA champion crowned fairly soon. Game 1 Eastern Conference Finals is in the midst of its action right now. We'll talk about that next right here on After Hours on 96.5 The Fan. We have a new MVP in the National Basketball Association. SGA, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, winning the first MVP of his career after leading the Oklahoma City Thunder to the best record in the NBA, 68 wins. SGA, a native-born Canadian, 26 years old, former first-round pick out of the University of Kentucky, averaged 32 and or almost 33 points a game this year, led the league. 5 rebounds and 6 assists. He shot over 51% from the floor, knocked down close to 36, right at 37.5% of his threes, and nearly 90% of his free throws in 76 games. No surprise. We knew no matter who won, who was going to finish runner up. Nikola Jokic finishes in the second slot. After these two flip-flopped last season, Jokic won the award last year. SGA finished second. Now SGA wins the award with Jokic finishing in second. Gilgeous-Alexander had 71 of the 100 first place votes. I feel like, and maybe I'm in the minority on this, I think this was the NBA's show of, okay, we can't just give it to the same guy every year. Because Nikola Jokic averaged a triple-double. not only a triple-double, he damn near averaged 30, 13, and 10. Nikola Jokic scored 29.6 points per game, third in the league. 12.7 rebounds a game, third in the league. 10.2 assists per game, second in the league. He shot 57.6% from the field, ninth in the league. He had a 50-40-80 season. Knocked down almost 42% of his three-pointers, a better percentage than SGA, and 80% of his free throws. He also averaged almost two steals per game. Yeah, I know what everybody's going to, well, he won the award four times or blah, 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 blah. He had the best season of his career. He had career highs in points and assists. He had career high in steals. He had a career high in three-point percentage. He averaged more rebounds, more assists, more points, more steals, and shot better from the three-point line than he did a season ago when he won the MVP. And this year, he doesn't win the MVP.
Do you think it mattered who won the series?
No, because it's a regular season award.
Then why did they hold off? So, like, that's my question.
Well, the NFL does the same thing. The NFL MVP isn't announced until the day before the Super Bowl. So, right, they don't announce it till NFL honors during Super Bowl week. It's a regular season award, and they push it off until, you know, right during conference finals, right before the NBA finals. I think it's to allow for extra preparation, right? To allow voters to go back and watch film and things of that. I don't know.
This is the latest it's ever been announced. And I think the only reason is because your two MVP favorites were playing against each other. So then your narrative builds. And to go back to your point about possibly why he didn't win it, I think one, there's voter fatigue. And two, there's a precedent that was set by voters for MJ. He has 4 to 6, whatever it is, MVPs. Yeah. No one can pass that. So it kind of like dwindled. Like, realistically, someone could, but LeBron was the most valuable player for 14 right. out of his 20-some years. He has 4 MVPs to show for it.
Yeah, and the argument can be made that Jordan probably should have won more MVPs than he did, right?
Oh, 100%. That's what I'm saying. It's just like, since he didn't, if they give Jokic his 4th, then he can no longer win another one, or just stuff like that, where, you know, these old precedents that have been set by voters in the past are affecting today's game.
Oh, without question. Yeah, I don't think anybody will ever surpass the 6 MVPs that Kareem won at this point. I just don't think that voters today allow for that sort of thing. It's funny that you bring up Michael Jordan, because that's maybe one of the bigger sticking points for what SGA accomplished this year and why he won the MVP. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander became only the 2nd player in NBA history to average at least 30 points per game, shoot over 50% from the floor, bring down 5 rebounds, dish out 5 assists, have over a steal and a half a game and over a block a game in a season since Michael Jordan did it in 1987-88 and in 1990-1991, when he won the first of his 5 MVPs, the first 2 of his 5 MVPs. So he put up a stat line that nobody's seen since MJ, and you give him that, right? Nikola Jokic did make history in his own right, even though he didn't win the MVP. He has now become only the 3rd player in NBA history to be in the top two, in MVP voting for 5 consecutive years. The only other 2 to do it, Larry Bird did it from 81 to 86, and Bill Russell from 1958 to 1963.
Didn't he also set something for being top 3 in points, rebounds, and assists for the entire league? Like, he was one of the first person to ever be in the top 5 or top Correct. 3 at the same time?
Yeah, around there, yes. Yeah, because I think, like, even like the Big O or Russ, when they had their triple-double seasons, I don't think their rebound numbers were in the top 5 of the league.
I also don't think their points were either.
Fair.
Because you're thinking about that was the year when, like, Russ, for example, that's when Harden averaged 40 for a month.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot to be said for this year. It's the 10th instance ever that a player leading the league in scoring did it for a team to win more than 60 games. And of those 10, only one of them did not win MVP. And that was 1996-97. Jordan didn't win the MVP that year. Karl Malone did. So there was a lot of history that pointed to potentially SGA. He became the fifth player ever to have at least 30 points per game and shoot better than 50% from the floor in three straight seasons. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Kareem, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Wilt Chamberlain, and Michael Jordan. I don't know. There's numbers that point to both of these guys, but Nikola Jokic averaged almost 30, 13, and 10. He averaged a triple-double on almost 57, 58% shooting and scored almost 30 points a game. Pulled down almost 13 rebounds a game. Almost two steals a game. I'm sorry. Yeah, SGA may have won the MVP this year. Nikola Jokic is still the best player on the planet. But he's not playing anymore, right? His season is now said and done with. And speaking of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and the Oklahoma City Thunder, they put up a statement W last night in game one of the Western Conference Finals using a massive second half. They were down four at the break. Timberwolves led at halftime 48-44, and then the Thunder outscored the Timberwolves 32-18 in the third quarter, 38-22 in the fourth quarter. They end up winning by 26, taking down the Minnesota Timberwolves 114-88, as despite 28 points from Julius Randle, it wasn't enough. Anthony Edwards had a poor shooting night. He had 18 points on 13 shots. Rudy Gobert played 21 minutes and shot the ball three entire times. Nikhil Alexander-Walker and Dante DiVincenzo were 6 for 25 from the floor off the bench. You add in Naz Reid and they were 7 of 20 or 36 off the bench. Those three guys put up 36 shots, made 7 of them. Meanwhile, Shai had 31 points on 27 field goal attempts. Shai did not shoot the ball well last night. He was 11 of 27 from the floor, 0 of 4 from the three-point line. But what does SGA do well? Get to the free throw line. He was 11 of 14 from the stripe, as the Thunder certainly showed their depth. Kenrick Williams had 8 points. Alex Caruso had 9 off the bench. Isaiah Joe had 7. And you got 19 from Jalen Williams, 15 from Chet Holmgren, and 12 from Isaiah Hartenstein. The Thunder absolutely roll to a Game 1 victory. They're obviously off tonight, and they will begin things again tomorrow at the Paycom Center in Oklahoma City. Meanwhile, you've got Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals going on right now over on TNT. The New York Knicks hosting the Indiana Pacers. An Eastern Conference Finals that nobody saw coming, but here we are. And right now, the Knicks lead 69-62. Jalen Brunson with 18 points in this one. Karl Anthony Towns with 15 of his own. Mikal Bridges has 12, as the Knicks currently lead by 7. Leading scorers for the Pacers: Tyrese Haliburton with 14, Miles Turner has 12, Aaron Nesmith has 10. So the Knicks trying to get a statement home victory in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. And, you know, this is an intriguing finals, I have to say, right? Because you're not seeing any of the traditional powers in this one, right? I know everybody looks at the New York Knicks and them as a brand, but the Knicks, generally speaking, have not been a contender in years. Not since the days of Patrick Ewing. Could you really say that the New York Knicks could win an NBA Finals. And even then, you were sort of like, well, you know, they've got a great team. They've got Oakley and they've got Ewing and John Starks. And yeah, they got a great club, but they'll find a way. They'll find a way to screw it up. And they always did. You look at this team, they're probably the better team between they and the Pacers. And these are two organizations that haven't been in this position in quite some time, right? The Pacers, last time they were here was Paul George and Roy Hibbert and those Pacers teams. And they ended up getting boat raced by LeBron and the Miami Heat. And then in the East, you've got the Timberwolves, who were in this spot, this same position a year ago, and they lose to the Dallas Mavericks. And prior to that, they hadn't been in this spot in a long time, ever, really. And then the Oklahoma City Thunder, who are trying to get back to an NBA Finals for the first time since they had that big three of Russ, Harden, and KD that came up short against the Miami Heat, and then all hell broke loose. So it's interesting to see four organizations that haven't been to the mountaintop either in a very long time or ever with an opportunity to do that for the very first time, right? We're not seeing the Celtics, admittedly, as much of a Celtics fan as I am. It's exciting to not see the Celtics or the Lakers or the Warriors or the Heat or the Cavs in a position like this, because they've all been there so many times in the last 20, 25 years of the NBA. We're seeing somebody new, new blood, right? That new generation of the NBA that we're all trying to clamor for. We're all trying to find that next generation. And with the Knicks, you've got Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns and Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart. And with the Pacers, you've got Tyrese Halliburton and Pascal Siakam, a guy who won an NBA Finals with the Toronto Raptors. The Thunder, you've got this young, exciting basketball team that I think the Thunder have an impossible task in front of them of trying to keep those guys around for the long haul. But SGA just signed the Supermax. You've got Hartenstein. You've got Chet Holmgren and Lou Dort and Jalen Williams. That team's exciting. And then the Timberwolves, who have possibly the future face of the league in Anthony Edwards, whether he wants it or not. Sounds like he kind of doesn't. He just wants to play ball. But he's kind of that dude right now that everybody looks at as a young guy in this league that could usher in the next age. And then you've got one of the best post defenders of all time in Rudy Gobert. It's exciting. I have to say, it really is. 913-586-7965 is our number. Somebody in the text line said, stats-wise, you could argue that SGA had way more weapons on his team, which could have kept him back from his full statistical potential. Yeah, but it also could have aided in that, right? He's putting up less shots, but he has more open looks because you can't leave Chet Holmgren alone for long, right? You can't just sag off of a guy like Jalen Williams and Lou Dort with his three-point shooting ability. They're so good defensively that it adds possessions and those sorts of things, right? Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray is your second best player, but he has a ton of injuries. The third best player on your team might have been a Russell Westbrook in his late 30s coming off the bench, right? Aaron Gordon was good and bad, but he had the injury thing going on. Michael Porter Jr. has always been hot and cold. He had a better team. Yes, so maybe it took some shots away, but it also may have added some shots. Some open looks, certainly. I don't know. I think that argument goes both ways. 913-586-7965 is our number. You're listening to After Hours. Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard right here on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan. Oh, man. The Cags fans are going to be out in force. The Bring Cags to Kansas City train is not slowing down. Right now, Omaha is in a 2-2 game at the moment, and Jack Caglione himself, 2-for-2. So after a 1-for-4 game yesterday, he's now 2-for-2 already in this one today. And that is not going to quiet down the folks who are saying, get Cags up to Kansas City. Just give the guy a shot. again, personally, give it a beat. Make him, I don't want to say make him prove it, because he's obviously proven that he's one of the best hitters in baseball and maybe the best hitting prospect in Major League Baseball right now. But you saw his confidence grow and grow and grow and grow during his time in Double A, where you couldn't justifiably keep him in Double A anymore. I want to see that happen in Triple A. Now, if he finishes up the month of May and he's hitting 500 with four home runs and 15 RBI, okay, sure. Yeah, if he's hitting 500 in the first 15, sure. Yep, make the move, bring him in. That's fine. I don't think that that's plausible by any stretch. Give the guy a little bit of time. Let that confidence continue to blossom. Let him continue to play right field and feel like, okay, I can hit at this level. I can play right field at this level, right? Because he got that way in Double A. Let that occur again in Triple A, and then you reevaluate. But, man, the way he's hitting the baseball, I think that he's going to prove that he is far, far too good a guy to keep down for long. But we'll see. Couple of other stories out of the National Football League. Surprises nobody. Not that he wasn't going to sign. But the Tennessee Titans have officially landed number one overall pick Cam Ward. His four-year deal is worth $48.7 million. Fully guaranteed. It also includes a fifth-year player option, which is the case with all first-round picks. He was on the field for rookie minicamp and OTAs, despite the fact that they didn't have a plan or a deal in place. So no surprise there, as the Titans have landed what they hope will be their franchise quarterback. Speaking of franchise quarterbacks, how about Brock Purdy, the former Mr. Irrelevant, former Iowa State Cyclone. We all collectively boo when I say that. That five-year, $265 million deal. And with the comments, he said, quote, being here day one was a huge emphasis for me, regardless of having a contract done or not. But I had a lot of faith in my agent and the Niners that they were going to get something done. He now is looking forward to the 49ers being able to build around him. Good luck. You now hold 20% of your team's overall salary cap. And with extensions already in place for guys like George Kittle and Fred Warner and Brandon Ayuk, I don't think it's entirely plausible. Nick Bosa is on a big deal. Trent Williams is on a big deal. You had to deal away a huge chunk of your roster. I think this is good news for everybody in the National Football League. Obviously, it's good news for Brock Purdy. Good news for the 49ers because they have their quarterback for the long haul. But I also think it's good news for the rest of the NFL because it now means that it's going to be incredibly difficult to try to surround him with added pieces. When you're paying all that money to Purdy and Kittle and Warner and Williams and Bosa, that's a huge chunk of your salary already. But I'll give Purdy some credit. He did give the Niners a fairly team-friendly deal. I mean, he could have tried his best to try to get, you know, maybe not quite Joe Burrow money, but near Joe Burrow money. And he didn't. However, it's still a massive chunk of change for what the Niners want to do in the future. 913-586-7965 is our number. We'll take our final break here, come back, and wrap up this Wednesday night edition of After Hours right here on 96.5 The Fan. Logan Weber alongside Jacob Mustard, your home for Kansas City sports. Let's get into some stories about offensive linemen, shall we? First one here, as we wrap up the show here tonight on this Wednesday night edition of After Hours. The NFL is introducing a Protector of the Year award. This is something that we talked about a few months ago on this program after after a lot of discussion was had during the offseason about why there's no, right, there's the MVP award, there's the Offensive Player of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year award, but we never saw anything that was representative of the best offensive lineman in football. And I hate to give the guy credit because he plays for the Buffalo Bills, but Deion Dawkins was the guy that really kind of introduced this to the mainstream, talking about, you know, why we don't have anything of that nature. And now here we go, including, I mean, and actually Troy Vincent, the NFL executive vice president of football ops, gave credit to Deion Dawkins and former tackle Andrew Whitworth for pushing for the creation of this now of this new award. It will be handed out to the league's best offensive lineman. It will be decided by a panel that includes a number of former offensive line greats. So it's not just going to be an award that's, you know, put out by voters or people on Twitter or what have you. There's going to be actual reputable people that are going to be voting upon this award and making a determination for who will be the quote unquote protector of the year moving forward. And honestly, I'm all in. I'm all for it. My other offensive line story, Adam Tyker, formerly of ESPN, has said that he believes Josh Simmons is the number one option at left tackle coming into this season. He believes that Josh Simmons will start at left tackle, and he believes that's how the Chiefs see him, is starting at left tackle for the Chiefs, and that Jalen Moore will start at right tackle, which would be fascinating, because I don't know if Jalen Moore has played any real, I mean, a ton at right tackle in the National Football League, and Josh Simmons is dealing with a ton of injury issues. He said in 2026, he definitely sees Josh Simmons at left tackle, Jalen Moore at right tackle. As a matter, he said, a matter of fact, if you're asking me how I'd go, I'd say, yes, your 2026 offensive line, offensive tackles are Simmons at left, Jalen Moore at right. He is firmly of that belief. What does that mean for Juwan Taylor? Obviously, it means that this is his final season in Kansas City. I think that that was going to happen regardless, but I think it would be even more interesting if that were to happen this season in 2025, because then you just have a $20 million backup tackle. Seems like a waste. That's not a smart use of funds. But at the same time, if Juwan Taylor is the better option, if Jalen Moore is the better option at right tackle, then that's what you have to do, right? I don't care how much one guy is making versus the other. You put the best guy at the position out there on the field to give you the best chance to be successful. I'm still not sold. Maybe Adam Tyker's hearing things that I'm not. Obviously, the guy's much bigger in this business than I am. So maybe he has, but until I hear something definitive, right, whether it's from Andy Reid or from Matt Nagy or whoever it might be, that, hey, we think Josh Simmons is going to be our day one starting left tackle, until that day comes, I'm of the belief that he doesn't play much this season. I still have concerns about the injury. I still have concerns about the, you know, what scouts had heard about him, about, you know, he doesn't practice incredibly hard. He doesn't have much of a belief in run blocking. Although I feel pretty strongly about the fact that Andy Reid and Andy Heck and the Kansas City Chiefs as an organization can get him to buy in. And if he fully buys in, I think Josh Simmons is capable of being your starting left tackle for the next decade. Without question. He has got Pro Bowl, All-Pro caliber talent. I mean, hey, folks. Trey Smith was a sixth-round pick. And at one point in his career, was considered the best offensive lineman in football. But injury issues derailed his draft stock, and people didn't want to take a chance on him. Worked out pretty well for the Chiefs there. Now they're just doing it in the first round with a guy in Josh Simmons at a position of high, high need. And I know there's going to be those people that are like, well, why did you sign Jalen Moore for $8 million a year if your plan was to just get a left tackle, get a guy like Josh Simmons and play him? better safe than sorry. Rather have too many options than not enough, because we saw what not enough looked like when Joe Tooney's playing left tackle and his inexperience at that spot and his lack of arm length and all those things catch up to him. The Chiefs have revamped this offensive line, and I think in a very, very good way, to where if Josh Simmons is healthy and he can do it, phenomenal. Great. That guy's your left tackle. My one stipulation, my one sticking point with Josh Simmons at left tackle, if he's your guy day one, he's got to be your guy week 18. You got to let him get through it, man. You've got to let the growing pains become a part of his journey, because they mismanaged that with Kingsley Suamataia last year. They threw him out there before he was ready. He got ambushed, and then they pulled him. Sort of like when you call up a great prospect and he struggles in the show, and then you send him back down and it throws his confidence completely out the window. That cannot be the case with a guy like Josh Simmons. If you're starting him week one, he's your left tackle unless an injury proves it otherwise. Just my two cents. That'll do it for tonight's edition of After Hours. For Jacob Mustard, I'm Logan Weber. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for being a part of the text line. We'll be back with you tomorrow right here from 6 to 9. We out.